Welcome to Clarity Fun Podcast. This is episode 14, and this series is brought to you by Logos Theological Seminary. I'm Dr. Owen Anderson, and we're joined by Dr. Surendra Gangadine, who's the founding professor at Logos Theological Seminary. And this is the second episode where we've been talking about rebuilding the historic Christian faith. Last time we were going over some of the background and coming to see what it means to say that it is clear that God exists so that unbelief is without excuse, and how that tells us about our need for Christ. And now we're going to look at some of the journey within the church to become more conscious and consistent about what historic Christianity has taught. And Dr. Gangadine, do you want to start there and talk to us about what is historic Christianity?
Good morning, Owen. Thank you for having me on the program. And yes, I would like to talk about rebuilding the historic Christian faith. And first of all, what is the historic Christian faith? And then later, what is rebuilding? Why is rebuilding required, and how that might go? The historic Christian faith is the work of the Holy Spirit leading the church into all truth. This is found in John 16, verse 13, that when the Holy Spirit comes, he will lead you into all truth, or guide you into all truth. That is, guide the church into all truth. And the first major example of that is seen in Acts 15, when there was a dispute concerning whether you must be circumcised to be saved. That would be equivalent to the question that has come up in the church after that, whether you must be baptized to be saved. And that gets us into the doctrine of the sacraments and the problem of hermeneutics, literal versus allegorical, or in contrast to both of those, contextual interpretation. But the historic Christian faith is the work of the Holy Spirit leading the church into all truth. The first example being in the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15, about 50 or 51 AD. Now, this came as a result of challenge of some from the Jewish community who were saying, unless you are circumcised, you cannot be saved. And the elders and the apostles gathered to discuss that question because it was dividing the church. So this historic Christian faith comes by the Holy Spirit through the work of the pastor teachers responding to challenges of unbelief.
I was going to ask about that there's a specific pattern that occurs, right, where you see a challenge raised.
Yes.
And then that requires a response, and that happens over and over in the history of Christianity.
And that is how the Holy Spirit leads the church into all truth, in responding to the challenges. And the church has responded to challenges in the past and needs to continue to do that, and has not been doing that for the past 400 years or so, or more. So it's the work of the Holy Spirit leading the church into all truth.
I'm going to ask it. That seems like a long time. If it's been over 400 years, but that does seem to be the pattern also, that there will be a council, and then there will be a time period where the meaning of that answer unfolds.
Yes, and that's what we've seen in the past period. The major response came out over about 130 years of discussion with many creeds, and they became summed up in the Westminster Confession of Faith that came out of the assembly at Westminster Abbey in England, the Westminster Cathedral in England, and they met for a period of about 4 years, possibly 5 years, in discussing a lot of the challenges that had been going on. And they did this in order to bring about unity in the church. So if I may try to finish a series of thoughts that hopefully bring it into focus. So it's the work of It's through the work of the pastor teachers, and it's done in response to challenges based on unbelief, whether inside or outside the church. And they go through a process of much discussion, as they did in Acts 15, and they came to agreement, and the summation of that agreement is expressed in its creeds and or its confessions. And they did that, and they put it into writing, and they sent it out to all the churches in order for all the churches to be in the unity of the faith.
Can I ask about unity as we're going? To have the unity of the faith, I'm not sure that's something that's a concern of very many people today, or they may think about unity at a level that does not include doctrine.
Well, that's why we say it's the unity of the faith. There are different kinds of unity. There's the unity of the Spirit in Ephesians 4, where you maintain the unity. You do not achieve it. You maintain it by being of a appropriate disposition with regard to truth and love. And then there's a functional unity that comes out of the unity of the faith, but we're to maintain the unity of the Spirit, go through the process of discussion until we all come into the unity of the faith. And by faith here, meaning common understanding of doctrine, drawing out implications and applying it. So, yes, there is a distinction between the unity of the faith and the unity of the Spirit, a distinction between functional unity and an ecclesiastical unity, outwardly through ecumenical councils of trying to coordinate outwardly. All of that is distinct from the unity of the faith. Perhaps we could put it this way. Jesus prayed for this unity when he says that they might be one, as you, Father, and I, Father and the Son, are one, that we may be brought to complete unity. So that understanding, no, you do not have to be circumcised to be saved, or no, you do not have to be baptized to be saved, was sent out to all the church that all may be on the same page and have unity. Now, the church continues to be divided about the sacraments because they're divided about the principle of interpretation. Those who do a more literal interpretation, as again saying the sacraments are signs and seals of the faith, they're not the reality. So baptism is a sign of regeneration. It isn't regeneration, nor is it automatically accompanied by regeneration.
Yeah, so even though the first council didn't mention that, it's talking about the same kind of thing in the sign of circumcision.
Yes, both signify regeneration.
And I think Peter concludes in that council that therefore we're saved by grace.
Yes, that's certainly the one implication and application. There are many applications of that when you think further about the meaning of it, but that's certainly one of the applications.
And I wonder about, you're mentioning ecclesiastical unity, different kinds of unity, and many people might try to put their trust in ecclesiastical unity or a judicial system within a church, but not have their trust in doctrines. And in other words, there's seems to be a difference between continuing in the teaching of the apostles. That's what the emphasis is on.
And that's what this unity of the faith, starting with the Council of Jerusalem and all the councils subsequently that build on this, this is the holy Catholic and apostolic faith, not church, but faith, and is what we are referring to by the historic Christian faith. Now, this first council, as well as the second creedal statement, the Apostles' Creed, over and against Greek dualism, we can affirm it at varying levels of consciousness and consistency. But we'll see that this is another huge step in either rejecting, in the first council, Judaic literalism, and rejecting also Greek dualism and allegoricalism, which has inundated the church through Augustine, Billing, and Plato, and Aquinas, Billing, and Aristotle, where dualism has crept back into the church and affected the church and ended up with an otherworldly view of the good as heaven. So these doctrines, as they're understood by good and necessary consequences, the assumptions and the implications are drawn out, it becomes a major significance in correcting and guiding the church into the unity of the faith.
Yeah. Well, what especially stood out about Greek dualism that the Apostles' Creed is responding to?
Well, when the Apostles' Creed affirms creation by God, I believe in God the Creator, maker of heaven and earth, Greek dualists say that both matter and spirit are eternal, and man is not a body-soul unity, but he happens to be a soul in the body, and salvation consists of freeing yourself from the chains and bondage of the body, as in Plato's allegory of the cave. We see that a dualistic worldview imposed itself on Christianity and captured some of its brightest minds who had not thought through critically what was being said. But if we think about the Apostles' Creed and the idea of the reality of creation by God, not eternal by some other spirit, and the incarnation, he is born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. He rose again the third day. He ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of God, from whence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. All of those emphasize the reality of bodily existence and the reality of the body and the body-soul unity. And it's not that we're a soul that happens to be trapped in a body and to be freed from the body by leaving and going to heaven.
Yeah.
So we can speak of this, that there's been seven major creeds or confessions.
And incidentally, that's a what you just said at the end of the Apostles' Creed, there is a major one, this teaching about heaven, that the goal of the Christian life is to get out of the body and go to heaven, still is with us today.
Yes. It is dominated, and in that sense, we have to go more deeply in understanding our view of good and evil. So,
the Apostles' Creed is so early in the church, and yet, as you said, a number of the early church fathers are working out of a Greek dualist perspective about the soul and the body.
We can see the work of the Holy Spirit in the first challenge to the church in understanding the Old Testament, Judaism's misunderstanding by literal interpretation. That was the first challenge. And then the second challenge is that many of the converts that came into the church came in under a worldview influenced by Greek philosophy. So the second council, the Apostles' Creed, was responding to the second major challenge. First, the Jewish challenge, and then the Gentile Greek challenge.
And I've seen people affirm that the Apostles' Creed especially it rejects Gnosticism in the sense of Christ came in the body, not just as a spirit. Yes. But I don't often see people connecting up and affirming God the Creator as opposed to the dualist view, which says God is merely the former of the world, not the Creator. Right. And also not connecting up this as affirming knowing God through the works of God instead of going to heaven.
Yes. So bodily existence and earthly revelation is not so good, and we had a kind of Greek mysticism dominating the church in the name of the contemplative life, which is apart from the work of dominion given by God to all of mankind, and to be crowned with a completion signified in the Sabbath. All of this is part of the biblical worldview understood more consciously and consistently that needs to be recovered. That's why we said at a foundation level, we have to rebuild the historic Christian faith. It's there, but it's not been held to that consciously and consistently. And now we are trying to, in response to challenges, hold on to what has been agreed upon already, but hold on to it more consciously and consistently. That's a program of rebuilding the historic Christian faith.
And we have that idea of unity that you brought up earlier. And I wonder if this doctrine of heaven is sometimes used to avoid the kind of unity we're talking about, because people will say, we'll kind of minimize a Christian life and say, you've got enough to get to heaven. You've done what you need, minimal yes. level. You'll get to heaven. And heaven could be either a kind of Epicurean afterlife, or it could be the beatific vision. But it's yes. either way, it's apart from God's creation. And so I wonder if, because of that, that minimizes our need for unity.
Correct. If I could achieve the fullness of blessing by myself after I die, there's several significant assumptions and implications of this. It means the good is not continuing from this life to the next. The beatific vision is discontinuous. It's not connected with the work of dominion, the knowledge of God through the work of dominion. It says something about human nature, that we're not fundamentally rational and the good must be cognitive, as against a non-cognitive state of mind, a mystical state of mind, and that the good is something accomplished in a corporate, cumulative, communal way through history, as was the work of dominion. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it, completed by the sign of the Sabbath. So here's where the biblical worldview of creation has been misunderstood. As we said, the temptation in the Garden of Eden was to put ourselves in the place of God, to understand good and evil differently than God understood it, God declared it, and established it by creation. So that's part of the project of rebuilding. We should just mention here that there are seven major creeds or confessions. The first is the Jerusalem Council. The second is the Apostles' Creed. The third is the Creed of Nicaea, where the doctrine of Trinity and the implications of that are spelled out. The fourth is Carthage, where the canon is spelled out. The fifth is Chalcedon, where the Christ is fully God and fully man is spelled out. The sixth is Orange, where the doctrine of grace is spelled out in contrast to Pelagian view of the fall and free will of man and works. And the sixth is the seventh is the Westminster Confession, which comes as the seventh creed within the Reformation, starting with the Augsburg, the Belgic, excuse me, the 39 Articles, Church of England, the Belgic Confession, the Helvetic Confession among the Swiss, the Heidelberg, the Canon, the Synod of Dort in Dutch, and then the Westminster. The Westminster sums up all of those, so we say that is one confession. But since the Westminster Confession ended in 1648, major challenges to that has occurred through Enlightenment rationalism, which characterized the modern world, and the failure of modernity in the reaction of postmodernism, especially in its contact with all the various worldviews, and lapsing into pluralism and a kind of ethical relativism and skepticism. The challenges of modernism and postmodernism remain to be answered. Because it has not been answered, those challenges have prevailed in the church, and our response to skepticism was wholly inadequate, and the church has largely become disabled, in bondage, in captivity to worldly views of epistemology, in terms of the assumption of naturalism and overextended empiricism assumed in science that all knowledge is through sense experience, as against some knowledge and whatever it is involves interpretation. So there's a lot of epistemological concerns that we must work
through. Well, that takes us through these seven, because we spent some time looking especially at the first two today, and we maybe can use that as a pattern we could use to then explain the others. If someone had questions about Nicaea or Orange, it'd be the similar thing, which is there's a pattern of challenges brought up and the response of the pastor teachers, which is a response that shows growth in consistency and awareness of the faith, all the way down to the Reformation and the Westminster Confession. And then you gave a good summary also, which you might go into detail in another episode, about the challenges since the Confession. And that follows the pattern that there are perhaps significant times between some of these councils in order to allow these challenges to work themselves out so that there can then be another council or another confession. It seems like that's an appropriate thing to have now.
Yes.
That there have been 400 years of challenges. You named, for example, secularism, and that's one of them, which need to be addressed. But another one is how we've understood our chief end, that we still have with us this otherworldliness.
Yes. So it's historically understanding Holy Spirit leading us into all truth. Understanding is historically cumulative. And if we don't build on that historically cumulative understanding, we'll end up building on historically cumulative misunderstanding. And so we have to go all the way back through all of this. But this goes back to an even deeper question of why God permits evil and how evil serves to deepen the revelation of God and how this conflict is worked out in history. So...
yeah, I think that's in chapter 6 of the Confession, Westminster Confession, right?
Right.
Why did God permit evil?
That and opening up the implications.
Yeah, so if our goal is to know God and all that by which he makes himself known, this Christian history we're talking about is one of those ways. We're getting a deeper understanding of the nature of God as we see this revealed in church history.
Yes. These are challenges raised up against the knowledge of God, and the church's response is to take captive every such thought and make it obedient to Christ. This is part of the age-long and agonizing conflict between good and evil.
And that can kind of help us conclude with that idea again of unity, because if someone is minimizing the need for unity, my suspicion is they've probably minimized the need for the knowledge of God also. And the other direction is true.
Or a different understanding of the knowledge of God, perhaps a non-cognitive, mystical, beatific vision.
Yeah, non-cognitive, mystical version. Instead of the more we want to know God and understand God, the more we would see the need for that to unify Christians.
Yes. Now, I should say this, and perhaps we might conclude with this, that we've not withstood the storms of unbelief coming by way of skepticism. It's prevailed against the church's fideism, belief without understanding, and the church's foundation must be laid more deeply, and it must be laid on the rock, a solid rock of clarity in response to the challenge of skepticism. Fideism is not an adequate response. It shares the assumption of skepticism that basic things are not clear. And so it gets back to what I was saying at the very beginning. How do you know that God exists? And can you show it? And is it clear? Some may say, well, it can be shown, but only by a very few. No, this must be clear to all, so that all stand in need of redemption because they've not sought and understood what is clear.
Well, and that might be a good topic then for our next episode, which is, what is the current state of the church? Yes. Where has it been left because of its reliance on fideism? How did it get to be where it's at now? So in episode 14 today, we've talked about rebuilding the historic Christian faith, and especially about the creeds of the faith leading up to the modern age and the challenges that we still need to address. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Gangadin.
Thank you, Owen.